You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. My name is Ted Gehr. I'm the Executive Vice President here at Brookings, and I'm delighted that you're joining us today for the Alan and Jane Batkin International Leaders Forum, featuring His Excellency Sauli Niinistö, President of the Republic of Finland. Good morning also. We have people watching on our webcast, so thank you for joining us as well. President Niinistö is the 12th President of Finland. He was inaugurated in March of 2012 and reelected just this past January. He has had a distinguished career in public service, including as Minister of Justice, Minister of Finance, Deputy Prime Minister, and Speaker of the Parliament. In a few short moments, he will share remarks on the challenges facing Europe today and on the role of transatlantic relations in meeting those challenges. Following his remarks, he will be joined by my friend and colleague, Strobe Talbot, who, among his many accomplishments, one of the big ones, he dealt with me as he was my boss as the president of Brookings, so kudos to him. Everyone should pat him on the back for that one. But it's very nice to see you again, Strobe. Strobe will lead a discussion with President Niinistö, including fielding questions from the audience. So as he talks, you might want to start thinking about which questions you want to ask. One quick reminder today, as the cameras would suggest, the event is on the record. And with that, let me again thank everybody for coming. Special thanks again for being here, President Niinistö, for coming to Brookings. It's probably been a pretty busy week this week in New York, so we really appreciate you making the stop at Brookings. So I'll turn it over to you now. Thank you.
So, good morning, ambassadors, ladies, gentlemen, and dear friends. I want to thank you for your kindest introduction. It is a great pleasure to join you here this morning. Like many of my colleagues, I spent the past few days at the UN General Assembly. The sentiment I took away from the speeches and discussions there is not new, but it became much clearer. We are experiencing a fundamental transformation in international relations. The balance of power is changing. The credibility of institutions is being tested, and completely new challenges pile up on top of the existing ones. While there are reasons for hope and optimism, fear and pessimism often seem to outweigh them. We are leaving many familiar things behind us, and the visibility ahead of us is very limited. That leads to uncertainty. And uncertainty and insecurity go hand in hand. This combination can be corrosive to the very fabric of our societies. We are rapidly losing our sense of community, a spirit of belonging, both domestically and internationally. Turning inward, we risk forgetting the value of working together. Let me be very clear. This is a dangerous development. We need to boldly intervene and start up shaping the future we want. In order to have a role on it, Europe has to become stronger. Ladies and gentlemen, the European Union was born in a previous era of insecurity, much more severe than one today. Out of the ashes of the Second World War, the six founding members started pooling their coal and steel resources and began the project of a single market. It was a community of nation states who decided to join forces and share sovereignty at their own free will. This principle has not changed over the decades. The member states are still in charge. People decide what the EU does. The European Union does not exist to serve its own institutions. The EU and its institutions are there to serve the interests of the member states and their citizens. And let's not forget that the European Union has succeeded remarkably well. Over several enlargement rounds, we have seen the internal market, the freedom of movement, and a growing number of common policies develop. They have created welfare and stability previous generations on our continent could never have imagined. That internal strength of Europe has also made the transatlantic partnership stronger. Building on solid foundations at home, the Europeans and Americans have jointly defended and promoted our common values in the world: democracy, freedom, and rule of law. For Finland, joining the EU in 1995 anchored us firmly into the community of nations and values we consider our own. I remember very well the powerful European spirit of that time, a sense of belonging. Unfortunately, that spirit has faded over time. It is not a secret that the EU is now in a difficult phase. Discord is overshadowing unity. Brexit is a loss for both the United Kingdom and the remaining 27 members of the Union. In some member states, national elections have brought in governments that are questioning the very values Europe is based on. In order to put our house in order, I believe rebuilding the European spirit is essential. When I talk about that spirit, it's not just a soft and idealistic goal. It is also hard realism. The spirit of belonging together increases our security and resilience. Without it, we are much more vulnerable to external threats. And it goes both ways. I believe that doing more together on security is the best way to strengthen that spirit. Ladies and gentlemen, the EU has plenty of tools to provide its members with soft security. Hard security and defence is where the Union has been slower to deliver. Ever since the failed attempt to create a European defence community in the 1950s, NATO has been the uncontested foundation for the collective defence of its members. And this continues to be the case. Also, to non-members like Finland and Sweden, NATO is fundamentally important for European security and stability. We highly value our close partnership with NATO. For 70 years already, NATO has, to a large degree, meant the United States. The Americans have shouldered the lion's share of the burden for European security. It has been highly valuable for Europe, and we fully understand why the US expects Europe to do more for its own security. And this is precisely what we aim to do now. I have been calling a stronger European defence for over a decade already. I'm delighted to see that there is finally movement in this field in Europe. the European Union has started its first so-called PESCO projects. From the US perspective, this permanent structured cooperation may sound technocratic, and the sums of money may seem tiny, but it is an important step in developing the EU's defense investment capabilities and readiness. There is now also a fresh discussion about the Article 42.7 of the Union's Lisbon Treaty. For those who are not familiar with the treaty, this article declares that EU member states have an obligation of aid and assistance by all the means in their power if another member is under attack. I'm glad that we are finally beginning to address what that would mean in a crisis situation. A core task of any union is to protect its own citizens. I know that European strategic autonomy is almost a dirty word for many here in Washington. Let me assure you, the growing European activity in defense is not an attempt to undermine NATO. On the contrary, it aims at developing stronger European capabilities. Those capabilities can equally be deployed through NATO, through the EU, through multinational coalitions, or nationally. This is not a zero-sum game. A stronger Europe means a stronger NATO, and a stronger Europe is a more useful partner for the United States. Finland takes its own defense very seriously. After the end of Cold War, we never let our guard down. Our citizens will defend their country, the will is strongest in Europe. Maintaining a strong national defense sends two powerful messages. It is a threshold against potential aggressors, and it makes us a more interesting partner. This is evident in our close bilateral cooperation with many NATO countries, including the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, in these turbulent times, a stronger Europe is in the interest of us Europeans. But my argument is that a stronger Europe is also a shared transatlantic interest. Let us just take a look at geopolitics and the two other major actors in the world. China and Russia are both seeking to increase their influence in our neighborhood, in Europeans' neighborhood. Russia has been doing it aggressively, flexing its military muscles and also using them, as we have seen in Ukraine and Syria. Chinese means have been more subtle. Towards Europe, both of them are currently showing a friendly face. Lately, we have not witnessed quite the same level of interest in Europe from Washington. When China extends its Silk Roads to Europe and attempts to buy its way into our infrastructure, it prefers to work with individual European countries and ad hoc groups rather than with a strong European Union. When Russia tries to rebuild its economic relationship with Europe despite of sanctions, it declares it prefers to work with a strong EU. But also with Russia, the truth may be more fragmented than that. Beijing and Moscow certainly have paid attention to the signs of a rift in the transatlantic relation. It cannot be in the US interest to have your major adversaries gain a bigger foothold in our European continent. A strong and united Europe is better equipped to resist them. Common competitors unite us, and so should common interests. I say this fully aware of the fact that the US and Europe now have open disagreements in many areas, from foreign policy to trade. But where can the US find a more reliable partner than Europe? The same question applies even if we think of the transatlantic relationship as a transactional relationship. Our economies are deeply intertwined. There may be trade deficits on one side, but services and foreign direct investments balance the picture. An open and free trade benefits us both. The transatlantic value chains foster competitiveness in European and American companies alike. Climate change and other environmental challenges will require completely new technological innovations. Our companies, universities, and research labs have a lot to offer to each other in this field. Together, we can ensure that standards continue to be set by democracies, not by others. Technological cooperation across the Atlantic will also help us face even more complex hybrid and cyber threats. And finally, beyond geopolitics and transactionalism, we should not forget how invaluable the transatlantic link is in its own right. I mean invaluable in both senses of the word. Extremely important, but also valuable beyond estimation. Something of such immaterial value that is impossible to measure in dollars or euros. Let's call the transatlantic spirit a sense of belonging together. We can't afford to lose it on neither side of the Atlantic. Thank you. Thank you.
I'll pour you some water. Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Good morning, everybody. This day is, at least on this premises, is off to a very good start. Mr. President, your speech is, I think, one of the clearest, most candid, and most constructive on these issues that we've heard for a long time. What I would like to do before we open it up to the audience is pick up on a couple of issues that you struck on in your speech. And both at the beginning and at the end, you made a point that there is a kind of a contagion, particularly in the community of democracies. And the contagion is that the nations involved are turning inward, and also segments within those nations are turning inward. And that could be tragic and dangerous. We're dealing with this in our country. There are a number of Brookings scholars around the room who are trying to go back and do a diagnosis on what's behind that. What is your own diagnosis of the problem in Europe?
I'm not a doctor, but nevertheless, Yes, you said that somehow nations are, well, turning in. We have to ask why. One element, not a total explanation for this, we heard this week in New York, in United Nations, the word patriotism very many times. And now we should think what each of us means by patriotism. We would like to define in Finland, in a way at least I have, that you love your country. You're ready to defend your country. But you do not have a feeling that loving your own country means something bad to other nations. No. On the contrary, you should feel that the more I love my country, I try to work with similar people elsewhere. But this would be, I guess, too easy explanation. Behind that, that people tend to, well, understand patriotism in a different way, that it is that we are important, nobody else, and we keep our interests and don't let anybody to come nearby. Something is behind that so many people in Europe here have started to think in this way, and I would say that the traditional political systems, even in democracies, have to look at a mirror. Something has not been made in the best possible way if people, so many people, think otherwise. What that mirror might tell, that is a bit difficult to say, but studying your own footprint, you maybe learn to walk more straightforward.
A good doctor would probably underscore that. Is there another part of the problem, and that is a growing resentment in European countries, as there is in the United States, with what they consider to be elitists who do not have their interests in mind. And so there's a backlash, certainly in the United States. We can see it in the low public opinion of our Congress and our the federal government. Is there something like that going on in Europe as well?
Yes, but maybe the picture hasn't changed that much. It has always been, well, a great pleasure for voters to say that, well, they don't know a thing. I mean, members of parliament, sometimes even president. but has the sentiment behind that changed somehow? I have heard quite often used the word elite nowadays, pointing out that elite is something that one must resist. It's again time to look at the mirror, whether we have created, both in business, in politics, a group of people who, well, rather discuss with themselves and are very wise and not maybe trying to understand, not accept, but to try to understand that some other people maybe think in a different way. Very many of those people I have met who have been very critical on different issues seem to be more satisfied after discussing with them if you tell them, well, I understand your point of view, but I don't accept it because my point of view is different, and then explain that. But many people are clearly satisfied. I have been heard, is the message. I have been heard. And Maybe we have now, during the social media, forgotten a straight contact and, let's say, a polite way of discussing, even if you disagree.
Understood. Let's go to the point that you raised after you did give us a sense of the wobbliness of the European Union. We understand and we sympathize with our European friends for the problems and the weaknesses that they have inside the EU. But you also have another challenge, which is that if you look to the east, there are two very, very large countries, and that is Russia and China, which are basically both resurgent great powers. And you look to the west and you see us, the United States, for the first time in 70 years is seriously pulling back. And I can imagine, if I were a pessimist, that vice between the East and the West would make it all the harder for Europe to get back on track. But I like to be, as my boss, Madeleine Albright, says, I'm an optimist who worries. As an optimist, I would like to think that these challenges on either side will actually wake up the European spirit.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Europe is not, and it should never be, a kind of unindependent continent moving from west to east, back to west. No, Europe must be strong enough to be Europe, one of the major players and actors in the world. And this is now the problem. If we look at, whatever conflict in the world, North Korea, Syria, Iran, we see three countries, in different combinations, solving these problems. That is USA, China, Russia. Where is European Union? European Union should be there too. And that would also balance. So Europe must be stronger. That is my message. And how Europe could be stronger? I don't believe in new, directives or new institutions or constructions if you don't have the spirit. And we Europeans, all of us, should understand that we all need European Union. Why I have kept up discussion on European security and European defense? It is because of, in history, I do not recall any union which wouldn't have seen that its most important task is to guarantee security for families and individuals. European Union hasn't done it. That is now time to do. And that would also increase, I believe, the spirit, European spirit. And that would also help Europe to become great again. After the Cold War, 90s, in the beginning of this millennium, we learned to live in a beautiful world. And for example, in Europe, very many countries reduced their defense forces because, war, that's so far away. Such things doesn't happen. But now we still should think in Europe beautifully, good things. But
we have to understand that there's also bad existing in the world. And you have to be strong if you want to deliver your good message. Because if you're weak, nobody believes you.
Well, that goes directly to another thought that came to me as I was listening to you. And that is the idea of mutual security guarantees is obviously what you're referring to, at least in
yep.
part. What are the ideas and the plans for backing the guarantees with hard power?
First, the agreement, Lisbon Agreement, was agreed, if I remember correctly, 2008. And there is Article 42.7, which is actually a stronger expression of mutual responsibility if we meet aggressive behavior, stronger than Article 5 in NATO's papers.
As strong?
At least as strong. It's written strong. I now talk about written, not concrete life. And so, but after after all the members signed the agreement, nothing happened. So we have a very strong expression in our agreement, but nothing behind that. And that kind of discussion has now started. I have tried to keep it on for at least 10 years, and I agreed with pleasure that the discussion has now begun. Because I come back to union. Which kind of a union is such that, if some parts of the union are under aggression, so we just turn our face and say, maybe we are less next week. I very often try to think about the United States and why people in Montana to Texas, in a way, when they see the flag or they read the Constitution, they have respect on that. There's the spirit, even though those people, according to my understanding, are quite different from each other, but they have the spirit. They belong to somewhere. And why Europe is not capable of creating this kind of spirit, that is a huge question. I do understand that European Union is quite young phenomenon if compared to United States, but if we go 100 years back in time, so you had the spirit here already, and then you were not that that old after Civil War.
You also referenced what you think is a controversial phrase here in Washington and the U.S., and that is strategic autonomy.
Yeah.
It doesn't frighten me at all, but I'm not sure I understand it, and I'm not sure how it will mesh with NATO.
Yes. Actually, I learned the expression from French discussion. They have been talking from 90s of two principles. One is strategic autonomy, and the other is solidarity with NATO. And these two elements, in their opinion, can fit together. I would define now strategic autonomy in a way that, like I said, that Europe must take care more of its security and its defense. And that is not at all against NATO. That is the solidarity, in my opinion. And I just repeat once again, to take care more of your own security. It means that you are stronger, and you will be seen stronger elsewhere also. And if you are seen strong, you get your voice in good, also heard better. So it's two-folded, in a way, the advantage. Not only that your capabilities in protecting yourself are increasing, but your capabilities in getting your message, good message, through are improving.
Well, a single person comes to mind, somebody who puts a lot of weight into his reputation for being strong, and that's President Putin. Mm. And you have remarkable experience sitting down with him, talking to him on the phone. Could you give us a little sense of the man himself and his strategy, and what does he really want at the end of the day?
Well, I want to repeat something which has been already in public, because I don't like to estimate people who are not present. But nevertheless, as a person, I was amazed to notice that he still keeps contacts to Finland, to people who he learned to know in early 90s, when he was not even number one in St. Petersburg. But he met in his office some Finnish city leaders or equal people than he was at the time. He never forgets it, because he was dealt respectfully. He even calls those people who are now retired, calls them to Moscow after 20, 30 years. So one element, he doesn't forget. He doesn't forget his friends. But unfortunately, this works also other way around. He doesn't forget if he has not been dealt respectfully. So,
how does he define respect?
Well, you should know the Russian mindset and Russian soul, maybe. Hardly in his personal life, but if we now talk about, and he compounds very easily, like very many Russians. My pride is similar to Russian, the state of Russia pride. And if it's hurted, the state, I'm personally hurted too. And I guess that if Putin is hurted somehow, he feels that it is against Russia too. And thus, it's a bit same thing, talk about respect of the state and the state leader. And I believe that respect means, it means what we mean it, but maybe a bit more, that respect is also a sentiment where might be a bit of, not necessarily fear, but let's say that others are careful when handling you. Careful. Not maybe fear, but careful.
Yes, we're hearing a lot about fear in this country, too. I'm going to just ask one more question, because we have a terrific audience here, and I want them to have back and forth with you. Among your passions, if I can put it that way, is doing something about climate change.
Yes.
Kirsty has sent me a number of your speeches. You never ignore that issue. And you, towards the end of your speech today, did so as well. I'm going to make a a very large point that goes off into the future. But all of us, no matter how old we are, have a stake in the far future, especially if we have progeny. And you've had a lot of tough things to work on this year, but you've had one glorious event. You and your first lady brought a little boy into the world. About 9 months now, something like that.
Eight.
But coming up to nine.
Yes.
His name is Otto. And Otto is likely to see in the 22nd century. And we're not going to see that. But our generation and the one coming up behind us is probably the last generation that can do something about climate change. And that resonates with our hope for our own children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Mm. Because we want them to be able to live in a livable world. Now let me go to a this year issue, which is the Arctic Council. And Finland, as I think most of you know, has the chair. How does that look? And are you getting some help and cooperation from our government?
Yes, if you allow me, I go a bit first to climate change as a whole. What happened to me was quite exciting. Well, we have to remember that in Finland, I do not believe that situation is very different here. 70% of all emissions comes from households' behavior. And what happened with me during these years was that when I go shopping, the early days I compared prices. How many euros is that? How many can I afford? Have I money enough to buy that? And do I find a cheaper one, or do I get more with my 100 euros than in this shop? Now, more and more often when I go to shop, I don't count it in euros, but I count it on how much impact it has on environment. And that pricing is totally different. It might be in euros more expensive, but you pick it up because it's cheaper for the future. And you might think, not anymore that can I afford that, but you ask whether I need it, absolutely. So this is something that I think that we all should start thinking. If it's in our mind, deep in our minds, it has a huge impact on climate change. Then I go a bit, or now I answer you, Arctic. We are chairing the Arctic Council now, and what happens in Arctic is very crucial. It's not a question of Arctic anymore, it's question of globe. If we lose the Arctic ice, we lose the globe. And one element, what we have now discussed a lot, I have put it forward with Putin and with Trump also, both of them have understood the problem and are, at least according their sayings, ready to do something. That is the black coal. You know, emission black coal comes from the sky and drops down to Arctic, and we all know what happens when white ice or snow is covered by black. When the sun meets it, the melting will accelerate a lot. And this is one of the points we would like to clear up during our chairmanship. And, well, we have proposed to arrange a summit that is for heads of states. And so far we have got positive answers, well, let's say, from most of the 8 member countries. Sometimes president has to be diplomat also. So most of the member countries. And there are other elements. For example, flaring. That is, they burn the extra gas in fields. We have all seen pictures of huge flames. And that is silly, actually. Well, you could use maybe that gas instead of burning it and creating a lot of emissions and black carbon. But it is expensive and it is a difficult issue. But these kind of elements we would like to take up when or if we have summit where heads of states will say that we save the Arctic.
Well, I know that there are...
Yes. Well, you went to Aro.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be a happy part of the conversation.
Well, this is a very personal part. Sometimes when I look at his blue eyes, I ask myself that what kind of a world those eyes will be looking in the future. And that, dear friends, puts you thinking.
Well, in his long life on a livable planet, he will know that his father made it a livable planet.
Hope so.
Let's open it up, if we could. Just a couple of things. If you would, I'll try to be as democratic as possible. Please wait until you get a mic. Please ask a question that's a sentence with a question mark after it, so that we can use the time that we still have to listen to the president. Okay? You, and then the lady behind. So we're going to 1, 2, 3. This gentleman here in the third row, that gentleman, and then the lady behind him.
Thank you very much, Strobe. Thank you, Mr. President, for just a terrific speech and dialogue. My name's Rafe Pomerantz. I chair a group called Arctic 21. Closer?
Yeah.
Louder?
Like a rock star.
Oh, that's me. Yeah. Okay. So as chair of the Arctic Council, there is this continuing opportunity to bring the attention of the world to, as you explained it, we call it the unraveling of the Arctic. The many components, Greenland, sea ice, permafrost, which threatens a massive feedback. There's great urgency to this and required ambition in both the Arctic and globally. My question is, would you consider using your platform as chair to convene some kind of global meeting that improves the spirit? There has to be a blending of the European spirit and the global spirit to save the Arctic and our planet. And your platform offers a major opportunity in the remaining months. There will be a foreign ministers meeting to close in May. You have an environment ministers meeting next month. If you have the summit meeting, terrific. But you have this platform. And the question is, are you willing to consider using it in a bigger way than you already have, which is you have done? Thank you.
Yes, actually, even though there are only these 8 members, permanent members, the Arctic countries in a way, which have a part of them in Arctic area, I have been talking about this, for example, with representatives of Maldives, because it's also their interest, even more than ours. So getting more people supporting and maybe putting a pressure to that's one of the ideas. But I want to be very clear with stopping black carbon. You haven't done so very much for the climate, to stop the climate change. But it's a very easy way of having an impact. And that's why it should be used. Yes. We use that platform as strongly as is possible. And I'm very delighted to have noticing that this message is understood. It was understood in White House, it was understood in Kremlin. And sometimes it is good to start with something concrete, even if it's not that big step. Because if you take a first step, maybe you are prepared to take another and plenty of more. That's why I'm selling this first step to those who haven't taken it yet.
Just one other thought came to my mind, and that is there is a lot of quite ominous activity in the Antarctic.
Yeah.
And is there any set of ways to get at that problem as well?
Yes. It is many times bigger problem if we are losing the Antarctic. Even bigger, a lot more bigger than Arctic area, and but I guess it's different. It is more depending on the fact that that climate is warming up. Surely that has an impact also on Arctic, but this kind of extra element like the black coal, I do not believe that that is a big issue in Antarctica. Climate change is, and it's dangerous.
Do nations in the southern hemisphere, are they getting together in the way the northern hemisphere?
We have to push them.
Yes.
We have to push them. And also in this respect, I mean, if we can do something to wake up people understanding the Arctic, maybe that leads to think about more about Antarctic surroundings too.
This gentleman here, I think, is next. Oh, sorry.
Saska Saarikoski from Helsingin Sanomat Finnish Press. Could you a little bit elaborate your thinking about European defense, about this 427? Some people have said that it's very open, you know, you must come to aid a country in distress, but it can mean like sending olive oil if you want to. So should that be defined more security-wise, kind of pinpointing in the military measures, or are you talking more about common European army, or how far are you ready and willing to go?
Like I said, it's a written text, but even though it's 10 years it was written, actually nobody is very prepared to answer what it means. That's why I have been asking for years from other European leaders, state leaders, that how you see this? How do you understand that your country understands this? Because it applies every country with all possible means to help. What are they? And nobody actually has so far answered to me, and I haven't answered. So now ongoing discussions, for example, with President Macron, well, I think that we little by little start to get to discussion what each of us means by that. I do not believe it means European army. For example, NATO has got an army of its own. NATO's troops are national troops, when and they only put the cock out of NATO if they are serving NATO. So it's not a relevant issue to create armies, because in Europe we have 28 armies, actually. But I can't actually answer you more exact, because there is not an exact answer, which we are looking after now.
Will there be progress during the course of this year, do you think?
Not that fast.
The lady here.
Good morning, President. My name is Sunjin Choi at Langham Partners. Finland will take over EU presence next year. So would you perhaps share with us what are the priorities? Since you are President of Finland, I also think about previous President of Finland, President Ahtisaari, and who is the recipient of Nobel Peace Prize. Also, he never forgot he was born in Vipri, a displaced person. He never forgot the experience. And for me, he's one of the best, finest example of global public goods. Also, he spent some time and restored Vipri Library, which is built by one of my favorite architects, Arpo Aalto. So I'd be interested in your views about Finnish government effort, how to integrate some of the immigrants and refugees in your country, especially education and professional career. Kiitos. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. What comes to Finnish program during the presidency of EU, well, I would like to see progress in getting more understanding to European spirit. If we can wake up European spirit in whatever form and connecting with whatever concrete issue, that would be a real victory. And, well, I haven't heard so very many people even talking about European spirit. Just to talk about that might also raise it. Otherwise, I have difficulties to say how our government, because I have no responsibility on EU policy in Finland, and I'm badly blamed if I take any comment on that. President Ahtisaari, what I didn't actually.
And he was born in Vipri. Vipri. Vipri.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, yes. You mean that he's a refugee himself?
Exactly.
Okay, yes. Yeah.
So I'll be interested in Finnish government policy towards integration with the migrants.
Yes. You maybe know that Finland received quite a lot of migrants a couple of years ago. And now the discussion is that whether we should increase the amount of the fixed amount of refugees we take every year. And I have said, well, this is just my opinion because I'm not deciding that, but I think we could increase that a lot with one condition, that European Union takes more responsibility of its borders and creates more unified criteria how the processes are being done. The context of processes is in international agreements, but how the processes are dealt, and then also how member countries show solidarity, because everybody must be prepared to take migrants. But the best possible situation would be that there are big migrant camps all over Middle East, Turkey, wherever, that people would stay there and Europe should pick up people from there. And in that case, I think Finland could well increase a lot its fixed amount of yearly fixed amount of refugees. We are doing our best to integrate those people. Although I have to admit that the phenomenon is a bit new, and we have a lot of people who came in same time, so difficulties there has been.
That gentleman there, the lady, and then that gentleman there. We'll do it in threes. Troikas.
Thank you. Markus Tiittola, Iltalehti, Finnish Media. President Trump had a press conference yesterday where he said that during his speech at the UN, people were not laughing at him, but they were having a good time. How did you personally see it? Did you feel like laughing? Did you have a good time? Or did you hear a speech that gave you reason to be worried about the future of United Nations and the international cooperation in general? Thank you.
Note that everybody's laughing.
Yes. I was about to say that. Can you define why people were laughing when you were asking? That is a very...
Out of respect.
Very difficult to define. Well, maybe the most important thing is that people were laughing, not showing another kind of face. And to whom they were laughing, that's all the same. I have seldom heard people laughing in UN, and it was kind of a fresh experience. Better than shouting.
Did you give you any reason to be worried about where things are going?
Now you mean President Trump's speech.
In general,
it was very similar, actually, than it was last year. Its context. No differences, but the way he put it forward this time was a lot more polite. I don't know whether we can read anything out of that, but nevertheless, he said in a different way same things he said a year ago. And for example, he's demanding the how to fix the UN, what kind of reforms should be done, or at least demanding reforms. And I think that most of us can agree with that. Institutions who live for a longer period, every one of them needs a reform every now and then. So that's one example. But otherwise... Well, in my speech, I had a different view in very many questions.
The lady right there, and then the gentleman there, and then we'll go to the lady next to him, or on the other side of the aisle.
Yeah, so Christina Spohr, I'm the Helmut Schmidt Professor at the Kissinger Center at Zeiss. I would like to ask about the global order and how you, from a Finnish perspective, see the challenge of the opening Arctic, if you think about the Chinese term Polar Silk Road and the unholy alliance between Russia and China when it comes to shipping in the far north and oil and gas mining. Thank you.
Yes, one of the elements we have taken up in our Arctic problem is maritime security, how to develop more security to the traffic in Arctic area. One element is also, and I think every member might be ready to accept it, is to forbid heavy fuel, using heavy fuel in maritime traffic there. Okay, well, that is a very interesting issue because we have heard that China is building the Silk Road and the Arctic Belt, whatever they mean by that. China is not a member in Arctic Council, so and that China has not any territorial rights in Arctic area. There has been a kind of dispute, according to my understanding, between Russia and China, what are free waters and what are not free waters there. And that might be an issue which would be interesting to take up also in Arctic Council, but that needs a summit.
Before we go to the next gentleman, I wanted to come back to one other issue about the Arctic, and that is the geopolitical and military and security issues. If the polar ice cap becomes the polar sea, that has huge implications, some of them quite worrisome.
Yes. So far, there has been an, gentleman's agreement that Arctic Council doesn't take any opinion on military issues. And I think that we keep that. But you're quite right. Geopolitically, Arctic is very interesting. If, like you said, polar sea, the ice would change to polar sea, I think the major problem would be environmental, however, because we have lost so much that it's almost all the same if there are military boats crossing. But nevertheless, there's a lot of room for geopolitical activities. And somehow I have a feeling that all, at least the bigger ones, they avoid talking about that, saying that, well, that's not a problem there. And then we have to think that, is it a problem that the big ones say that there's not a problem? Sometimes it might be.
Indeed. Thank you for your patience, this gentleman there.
Thank you, Mr. President, for your comments earlier. I really appreciate your visit here. My name is Lopez Carter. I am a strategic planning analyst with the Army National Guard, retired colonel whose last duty assignment was with the U.S. military committee, U.S. military delegation to the NATO military committee in Brussels, Belgium for 5 years. In 2002, at a Russia-NATO summit in Rome, Italy, they created the NATO-Russia Council. It is my contention, and I'm speaking on behalf of Lopez Carter, not the U.S. Army or anyone else, that the Russians use what we call in the United States Army in intelligence preparation of the battlefield. By that, I mean they studied the nuances of NATO collectively and individual member nations to understand how NATO might respond to any aggressive actions on their part. Hence, in 2008, the aggressive military actions against Georgia. A few years later, the aggressive military actions in Ukraine, the continued meddling in Western elections, the somewhat aggressive action against our NATO allies in the Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, with the very muted response from the international community. Not a zero response, but not a very aggressive response to these aggressive actions on the part of NATO, on the part of Russia. And I'm just interested in your perspective on that, if there should be a stronger response to these aggressive actions on the part of Russia, or if you agree with the present course and the present responses that have been done. Thank you.
Well, if you allow me, I just keep myself on Finnish experiences. That is that you have to be very straight and very decisive with Russia. That if you say something that is very straightforward going, in a very straightforward going way, and according to my understanding or experiences, they do believe. But I also want to refer to you from an old Finnish wisdom, which comes back from centuries, when you know Russia and Finland had quite many wars going on. The wisdom is as follows. A Cossack takes everything which is loose. A Cossack takes everything which is loose. So, fix everything. This is how we do. Not leaving unfixed loose.
Or ambiguity.
Yep.
Lady across the aisle.
Thank you, Mr. President. I am Wanmeng Liu. I'm from China, and I'm an undergraduate student at the George Washington University. And my question is, how can education make Europe stronger, and how can young students or young people not only learning taking care of themselves and their responsibilities, but also form the social consciousness and the willing to really care for the world and other people in the world? Thank you.
I didn't hear the rest.
Education.
Yes. Yep. Education in Europe for foreigners or?
No, I think we're...
I'm sorry. Okay.
Keep a bit closer.
Okay. My question is, how can education make Europe stronger?
Okay.
And how can education help the young people to form social consciousness? Thank you.
Thank you. Education in Europe, like education worldwide, makes us stronger. It's a similar phenomenon all over the world. And it is an important factor for the future, because the more you educate, the more you learn, and the more you hopefully understand also from our common future. I mean also climate change or the risks we are facing. Finland has always been very supportive on education. We have been number one in PISA studies very many times. And I have been often asked that, how is it possible? Is it you're using a lot of money or something like that? No. My answer is respect. If people respect education and people respect teachers, so the result is absolutely good. If a respected teacher gives to pupils and youngs information, and those youngsters respect having it. So the result is very good. We have to respect education.
I might just add something from this side of the ocean and in this country. A lot of people are convinced that we can overcome our societal and political problems if we put much more emphasis on civics and American history in our curriculum here in this country. Yeah. Yes, this lady here, and then the lady with the blue, and then we'll come back to you.
Hi, my name is Maria Anala. I'm a journalist at the Finnish News Agency, so also a member of the Finnish press here. In the beginning of your speech, you talked about how many people in many countries seem to be losing their sense of community and sense of belonging. And you said we need to do something about it. And you also mentioned that we need a stronger Europe because of that. Could you tell us a little more about what, in your opinion, we could try to do about it? What can we do? What can countries do? What can a stronger Europe do? What can all of us do?
Yeah. If we start from the European scale, I said also that Europe should secure people, give security to families, to ordinary lives, so that people can trust that whatever I'm doing, it's in my hands because I can take it, do it in peace. But if we go deeper down to different countries or nations, so to keep everybody as a part of society is, well, what we have seen in Europe and I guess here too, a bit difficult. More and more youngsters seem to somehow be outside the society. And that is a very severe problem. Maybe to some extent what I said about listening to be heard, that is of some help. But education is also here a very important factor, that everybody has a possibility taking care of that.
Yes.
Tervetuloa Washingtoniin, herra presidentti. I'm Maija Härkönen. I am a teacher. I work for Claremont McKenna College, which is located near Los Angeles. We have a Washington program here. And I have a few students here with me. Several weeks ago, we talked about the Baltic Sea area and the security situation there. And we also discussed about the Russian bases and the situation that has been rather tense there. Do you think that trading between Finland and Russia will increase in the near future? What is your opinion about the sanctions? Thank you.
Yes. What first comes to Baltic area, well, there are tensions, but I would say that the tensions haven't increased during the past few years. It seems to be, well, stabilized tensions. Well, that is better than unstabilized tensions, but nevertheless, NATO presence there in Baltic countries is so most important. And with Finland and Russia, what did you ask?
Economic relations.
Yes, they are not that large as people usually think. And I guess that Finland has been suffering more from the sanctions than any other European Union country. But in spite of that, we are very firm on keeping on the sanctions, as it is agreed between in the European Union decisions. Well, we suffer, but nevertheless, we keep them firm. What comes to the future? Well, everything is depending on how the Minsk agreement is fulfilled. Nothing has happened so far, so there's no way of opening up sanctions. And outside sanctions, yes, there's trading. Every country, also USA, has trading with Russia, but it is limited. And I see no change in nearby future.
Since that's a not hugely optimistic note to end on, I would like to end on one that is very much optimistic. It goes back to Aro.
Yep.
I would bet, and I certainly hope, and I know you do as well, that when Aro goes into, say, fifth grade,
yep,
he will be living in a European community with a European project that's getting its mojo back, and his dad will have helped. So please, first of all, giving applause to our guest, stay in your seats so that we can get him out for his next appointment. Thank you so much, Mr. President.
Thank you so very much. Thank you.
Thank you.